Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to our weekly podcast. My guest this week is the writer David Price Jones, known across the Atlantic and all over the English-speaking world as a novelist, foreign correspondent, historian, and most recently, autobiographer. David, welcome to Spectator USA.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, you have a history with The Spectator, going back to the early 1960s.
Yes, I was its literary editor, and I was also its theatre critic. They had a man called Malcolm Rutherford, who was the dog's body, and he gave me the job of theatre critic. He was very keen on Bertolt Brecht, so we had to write about him most of the time.
One of the first people you reviewed for them, I believe, was V.S. Naipaul, who died recently.
Do you know, I tried to get him to review, but he never would. He was working for Carl Miller, and Carl Miller and I were deadly rivals. And I tried to poach him off the New Statesman, and I failed. Vidya said he would, but he was always too preoccupied or too busy or too something to actually deliver. I thought I had him with a review of J.P. Donlevy, but I didn't.
Well, when you mentioned Bertolt Brecht just then, I remembered, it is true, of course, that the past is a different country. And did you find, when you were writing your autobiography, or your family memoir, in a way, Fault Lines, which it came out in 2015, did you find it difficult to explain to people, the modern reader, if there is a singular person like that? Did you find it difficult to explain to them how the past was?
Well, my past seems unbelievable, so I can't explain it to myself, let alone to anybody else, which is why it's called Fault Lines, because my family inhabit a lot of fault lines. I think I'm antediluvian. It doesn't approach the modern world at all, does it?
You were born in Vienna in 1936.
Yes, I'm definitely an escaped Central European cafe intellectual. That's what I am.
And your parents, tell us about them.
Well, my mother was, she was also, like me, born in Vienna. I was born in the same room as my mother, eventually. And my father had gone to Vienna to, I don't know why he went, really, because he used to say it was to study music, but I can't find any evidence of that. He was, of course, actually a very musical man. And he married my mother in 1934, and I'm born there 2 years, 2 years later. And then 2 years after that, of course, out we go.
Right, and the fault lines you describe, of course, are those of nationality, language, religion, race, sexuality. It's an amazing story, and in a way, it seemed to me, could only have arisen from the cosmopolitan pre-1914 world. The roots of the story go back further than the 1930s.
Yes, I think in a way it's quite a typical story of self-made people on the Welsh side and on the Jewish side and on the Austrian side, all self-made, so then their children are able to enjoy good fortune and their children, the grandchildren, all become artists and layabouts and no good at all. Cafe intellectuals.
Right, well, self-makers, in a way, that maybe that's something that people learn to do. Your father, of course, was a well-known literary journalist, Alan Price Jones. Did you pick up something of the writer's business? I don't know about the writer's art, but simply the way of making a living as a writer, from seeing it done at close hand?
Well, I think I did. I was, I'm afraid, just an obedient child. Everybody around my parents was writing. The place was full of proofs and galleys and articles, and that's what they were doing. And my father had an enormous pile of books by his bedside, and he would just churn his way through these books. I don't think he actually read them. I think he's somehow literary editor absorbed them. He probably read three pages here and three pages there. But that's what... If that's what everybody's doing, that's what I was doing. If my father had been an electrician, I probably would have been an electrician as well. I'm afraid I'm not a very rebellious or adventurous child.
One of the things that is one of the most astounding early episodes in Fault Lines is that you're almost stranded in France after the German invasion of May 1940.
Yes, I was. My father... joined the army in 1939. He was in intelligence. He was sent to Cambridge to do an intelligence course. He spoke very good German. And he actually spent the war, most of the war, at Bletchley. My mother was with him, and I was with my mother's family near Paris. And in June 1940, my mother's brother, my uncle, came in to the house and said, "We've all got to go now. The Germans are coming." So we had to run from the Germans in June 1940. And we went to Bordeaux, and there my uncle, another uncle who was a Spanish diplomat, found the Spanish consulate was shut. The Spanish consul had been too frightened either to issue visas or to restrain, stop issuing visas. And he'd just done a bunk. So my uncle opened the Spanish consulate and gave people the right paper to get into Spain. He was sacked immediately by the Spanish foreign minister, Serrano Suñer. And so Eduardo, who was married to my mother's elder sister, took us all to Spain and then to Morocco. And I find myself escaping the Germans and finishing up in Morocco.
How old were you then when you came to England?
I was about six.
Right, it's 1942.
Yes, my parents didn't know if I was alive or dead. That was a tricky one for them. But when we got to Morocco, they said to my aunt and uncle, "Send him home." And my aunt and uncle said, "There are no bombs in Tangier and the food's all right and the sun is shining." They tried to keep me, but they lost. My mother eventually put her foot down and said, "Send him home."
And what were your impressions of arriving in England?
Well, I remember thinking as we went in the train, the plane, a Portuguese plane, landed us at Bristol, and my parents came to fetch me and to put me on the train. And I do remember thinking, who are these funny old people? Well, what are they to me? And it was all slightly unemotional in a way, which was odd because both my parents were very loving and affectionate people. And my mother must have been longing to get hold of me. I couldn't speak proper English at that point because it was all French spoken and a bit of Arabic in Tangier. So there are people who they're all dead now, but there were people who remember me speaking with a horrible French accent.
But you became one of those funny people. You became an Englishman.
I became an Englishman. I did indeed.
Who you were at Eton and Oxford and the Guards.
All that stuff, yes. Eton, Oxford and the Guards is an absolute kiss of death, isn't it?
And when you started writing, I mean, I'm struck by some of the topics that you were drawn to as a writer. How were these influenced by those early experiences? For instance, having picked up a bit of Arabic and then writing a book about Arab society, or having escaped from France in 1914, well, writing a book on collaboration, or would-be collaboration, I should say, the Mosleyites in Britain, or on France under occupation.
I think the common theme in everything that I've done, really, is what makes people believe the extraordinary things they do believe. How is it possible to be a Nazi, a communist, and a jihadi? How is it possible to kill people in the name of something? And I think, really, it's the examination of belief is really my subject. And I've been interested in all the isms. As a result of that. And I think probably beyond that, it's that I'm asking, are they going to get me? The Nazis took everything from my family, and what was left, the communists took everything from in Hungary and Czechoslovakia from my grandmother. And lo and behold, there are Muslims who want to come and get me because of my Jewish blood. And I dare say I'm thinking, how am I going to defend myself against this? How am I going to make these people see that I'm the same as them?
I mean, when you are looking and trying to understand that kind of belief, I mean, firstly, one thing, that's intellectual work, and certainly in Britain and also in America as well, there's almost a distrust of intellectuals as alien, you know, and engaged upon dubious work. But I think you're right, these things can only be understood intellectually. Where do you locate the motivation for people subscribing to ideas which often very quickly come to seem daft or irrational or incomprehensible. Is there a material explanation? You know, is it to do with the terms of the Versailles settlement, or is it some kind of long-running spiritual crisis in European or Christian civilization, or is it just because people have bad habits and always fall back into them if they're given the opportunity?
Well, although I think logic and reasonableness are common human attributes in every single person ever born, nonetheless, people love the irrational. And there's an enormous amount of superstition. I mean, Nazism and communism, and these are superstitions, really. And they're built upon irrational thinking. So I'm afraid it's the probable answer to your very difficult question is that it's human nature. And people love to hate. They really enjoy that. And if they find a good reason to hate, I mean, if you're born a Serb, you know you've got to hate the Croats. And if you're born a Croat, you know you've got to hate the Serbs. And that gives you something to do. And it fills your life. And then you don't stop and say, wait a minute, I'm being irrational. But you are being irrational. And that's good for telling stories, which is what I can do.
As a young man, you were in the army, and you were part of, in a way, the end of one of the great historical stories in the end of the British Empire. And not to compare it to these other ideologies, but that was an idea which had a powerful hold over not just the British, but influenced people all over the world, and then ceased to exist. You were in the army at the time of the Suez Crisis.
I was, yes. We were due to go to Suez, too. We blankoed up and painted everything yellow. And then it was a tremendous military cock-up, and so we didn't go. The army found it very hard to forgive Lord Mountbatten and Anthony Head, the minister responsible, for making such a tremendous mess of it. It was as if we were attacking the Germans in the West Wall. You know, they bombarded the Port Said for a fortnight before. It took the Israelis 48 hours. It was unbelievably badly handled. But I'm not an anti-colonial man. I get angry when people, which they do now, slang off the empire. The poorest countries in the world are poor because they were never colonized. If Yemen and the Horn of Africa and Afghanistan and so on had been colonized, they'd have entered the modern world. We wouldn't have had the horror that we're now having. What the empire did was to bring these people into the modern world, and it did so by giving them all sorts of cultural things. For instance, the English language. For instance, honest judges, which is an incredibly important thing. For instance, animal welfare. The very first thing that the army did on capturing Egypt in 1882 was to put an end to a cholera epidemic. So, you know, the medical side of the empire is extremely important. It must have saved literally millions of lives. So, of course, there are horrors. There's famine and bad administration and so on. But in my judgment, and in my romantic imagination, it's much more on the plus side than on the minus side.
In the 1950s, after Suez, were you aware of the great change that was taking place? People talk now often in two different ways about the 1950s. It's either depicted as a drab decade where nothing much happened, as if it was people were storing up energy for the 1960s, or it's depicted as a sort of a false start in a way that in the rebuilding of European life after the Second World War, there was a great cultural development that was in some ways stopped by the rise of pop culture in the later part of the 50s and the 60s. How did you see the position of Britain at that time?
Well, the 50s were a very nice time for me. I greatly enjoyed my national service. I mean, I was in a wonderful regiment, and they'd done extremely well in the war, and they were the men who won the war. And I felt I owed them a great deal. And I travelled a lot. You know, you could spend the whole summer in Greece for 50 quid, including the fare to get there. I didn't notice the 60s, to tell you the truth. I mean, the Beatles I find extremely boring. They're monotonous. They just, and they've got nothing to say, to me anyhow. And the Rolling Stones are even worse. I'm told that he's actually an intelligent man, but I wish he'd show signs of it.
Mick Jagger, he likes cricket.
Well, that's a good thing, too.
It's a sign, yes.
But I was busy writing in the 60s, and I just got on with that. Frederick the Great said you must teach the young to have an interest in literature because it will stand them in good stead when they're old. And that's plumb bang right.
Well, one of the things that's astounding reading Fault Lines is the variety of great writers that you've known. I mean, you knew Evelyn Waugh, for instance.
Well, it was really the gift of my father. I mean, he really did know everybody. It was quite extraordinary. And it happens to me all the time that people say, you must be Alan's son. And I'm very glad to have this round my neck.
In the book you describe going to Waugh's house.
Yes.
With his daughter. Teresa.
Yes, Teresa, she invited me for the weekend. We drove from, we were both undergraduates, and I had a little car, and we drove to Combe Florey. And as we turned up in the front of the house, the window on the first floor shot up, and there was a red-faced Evelyn Waugh shouting, "Go away! Go away!" So I said, "What do we do now?" And she said, "Well, when Papa's like that, I suppose we better had go away." So we just turned around and drove back to Oxford.
It seems to me that in hindsight now, people talk about three people in particular as marking a high point of English letters in the middle part of the 20th century. And they tend to be George Orwell in essay form, Waugh as a novelist, and Cyril Connolly as a critic. I suspect you're too young to have known George Orwell.
I'm too young to know George Orwell.
But the other two, you
yes, knew. I knew Cyril extremely well. And wrote a book about him. This was certainly quite a formative thing for me, that my father had a proof copy of 1984, and there was a lot of talk about what are we going to do in the literary supplement about this. And I started reading it. I was about 12, 13. And I'd read the beginning and was fascinated by the clock striking 13 and all that. And I got back to Eton, and I went to the school library and asked if I could have a copy of this. And the school librarian, who was a very old man, said, "Boy, you're asking for filth. I'm going to report you." And he did report me. And so I thought, oh, my God, what have I done now? And my housemaster came in to see me in the evening and said, "Mr. Catley has reported you for asking for George Orwell. You must forgive him. He is a very old man."
And Orwell, of course, was an old boy of the same school.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was a kind of sort of ghostly presence about that, because he'd been in college and all the colleges read him. And I think he had George Orwell had an enormous influence on my generation. He taught us not to be communist.
This is always a hypothetical question which arises, which is, had Orwell not died of TB, where would he have ended up on the political spectrum as the Cold War really got going? Or even later, if he was to see himself towards the late 60s as the new left arrived, where do you think he would have landed if he had retained those same opinions?
Don't you think he'd have had the same evolution as Arthur Koestler? He would have fought the Cold War the way that Arthur Koestler did. And would have been threatened with death sentences all the time by the... Think of the articles in Humanity and Lunita and all the rest of it. I think that he would have drifted to the right in the way that Arthur Koestler did, humanly.
He is one maybe of the unacknowledged parents of neoconservatism, as it's called when somebody made that shift.
That's right, don't you?
I'd like to think so.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Of course, he was very keen to decolonize everything, and so perhaps that would have kept him on the left, his days in Burma.
Connolly, how did you meet him?
My parents' house was destroyed in a bombing raid in the war, and they went to Summer Hill, the house of Sir Henry Davidor Goldsmith, a wonderful figure, who was in those days a colonel commanding the East Kent Regiment. Harry had a big estate in Kent, and he offered my parents, my homeless parents, a farmhouse on his estate. And Harry was knew a lot of intellectuals and writers and so on. He was sort of one himself when he wasn't being a master of foxhounds and a member of parliament and all the other things he was. And Cyril Connolly was a great friend of Harry's, and Cyril used to come to Summerhill. And one of the ways we had to pay rent to Harry and Rosie Davidor Goldsmith was to go to and have dinner with them at weekends. And they were unbelievably generous people, and Cyril was exactly the sort of person that they wanted to have. And he very much enjoyed lots of good food and very good wine at somebody else's expense. So there were we used to have lovely weekends with Cyril when he would tell us what he was doing and read his own piece in the Sunday Times and go to Tunbridge Wells, where there was a tea shop, and would have poached eggs in between the meals at Summerhill. And there was a very good bookshop in Tunbridge Wells, and Cyril used to go in there and come out with armfuls of books.
In 1963-64, you were literary editor of The Spectator, and then shortly afterwards you became a former foreign correspondent, in a way, a sort of roving magazine writer for The Telegraph.
There was a very great patron of the editor called John Anstey. John asked me to write, and I wrote something about New York, actually. I had been in America at that time. And as a result of getting a foot in at the door of the Telegraph magazine, John Anstey offered me a wonderful contract, which was that I could write as many or as few pieces as I liked in the year, but I would get a monthly check. So it took away all financial strain and allowed me to write the stuff I wanted to write. So some years I wrote, let's say, 12 pieces, and in other years I wrote 3. And I travelled all over the place, to Russia, China, the Balkans, and I covered the wars, the 67 war and the 73 war, all for John Anstey and the Telegraph. And everybody on the Telegraph used to raise their eyebrows. I never had any crosswords or any rejection or anything at all. He used to just say, dear boy, go down to the accounts and get the money and off you go. And when I came back and handed the piece in, dear boy, thank you so much for your piece. He was meanwhile asking Graham Greene to rewrite and Arthur Koestler to rewrite. And he was unbelievably picky and difficult. I must have had 100 pieces clear. I call that favour.
They don't
make
them like that anymore. I was reading recently Saul Bellow's account of the 1967 Six-Day War, and he sees virtues of war as teaching people a social lesson and so on, or finding a purpose. Was that your impression?
No, I don't think so. I'm sorry to say that I did very much enjoy the war. Seeing troops doing things and saying, oh, I know what that is, that's fire and movement. We used to practice that at Pickering. And I remember thinking that my own military service was extremely useful in interpreting all this stuff. But I was very surprised to find I wasn't frightened. And I was much more interested in my own reactions than other people. It's very remarkable to see great courage, too. When they took the Golan Heights, two elderly gentlemen in khaki shorts were unrolling a vast cable, which was a telephone cable. They were under fire from the Syrians. These were two elderly postmen, Jewish postmen. They paid no attention whatever to the fact that there was artillery and automatic weapons all over the hill. And I watched that with absolute amazement. They were only laying telephone cable for, you know. War is like that, I think. You the detail, the surprise all the time. Mind you, the Arabs fought very well, and it's a mistake to think that they're not fighters. They were brave people, and many of them died where they stood. If they were better led, if they didn't have political officers, they would be very much more formidable. But the officers all run away because they're going to protect their jobs, and they leave the men to do the fighting, and the men did fight.
And you wrote an account of Arab society, the closed circle.
Well, I saw things. I was travelling a lot in the Middle East and among the Arabs, and I got on extremely well with them. It was the end of a certain Arab way of life. There were still old gentlemen in tarbushes and sitting in cafes with wari beads. and leading civilized lives. And there was a some fine old people, Aref El Aref, I remember, and Mahfouz in Cairo. And it was the end of their civilization, and they became politicized and militarized by thugs like Nasser and Saddam Hussein. And it was such a human tragedy, and it was so instructive. It taught me such a lot. And I couldn't understand why it was happening. I couldn't see why there were these flights, a mass fleeing of whole populations, and why one particular identity set upon another particular identity to kill them all. Mm. It couldn't do them any good. So I eventually tried to put together all my thoughts about what I'd seen and what I'd tried to understand in a book called The Closed Circle. And that's been in print for a long time. And it earned me, surely, one of the greatest compliments I've ever been played, which was to be attacked by Edward Said.
Did you see similar things taking place behind the Iron Curtain, maybe in a more discreet way, but in the sense of ideologies being imposed upon populations that had been shunted around and were being given a false version of their history, even?
They were given a false version of that. It's absolutely right. But that's one of the things, by the way, that the British Empire did, was to give back a lot of people their history, which was extremely important. I mean, figures like Sir William Jones in India.
Scholar of Sanskrit and so on, yes.
I mean, he taught the Indians to be what their history had been and to be proud of it.
Do you find that people now have perhaps forgotten the Cold War too quickly?
Well, I think that is unfortunately true. I gave a talk to some undergraduates and mentioned the Cold War, and one of them said, "What are you referring to?" He was a medical student, mind you, but all the same, it was pretty frightening. It's very difficult to be charitable about Putin, isn't it? I mean, what he's doing is getting a kind of civilian version of a communist society. There was a military version of it, and now there's a civilian version. I mean, the way he treated Khodorkovsky, for example, is pure Stalinism. He just destroyed him because the man stood in his way. And there wasn't any talk of negotiation or compromise. He just destroyed him. I think if you can't understand the Cold War, you can't really understand Putin and what's going on. And I'm also pretty sure that the whole of the Eastern and Central European states, like the Czech Republic and Hungary and Poland and all the rest of it, are against the EU because of their memories of what it was like under communism. To understand Orban and so on, you need to know about the Cold War. You need to know that the Russians put down the Budapest Revolution in 1956 and so on. I understand that history is just now become a half-forgotten subject, hasn't it?
Well, it's something, I mean, that happened to you. It's one of the things that comes across very clearly in Fault Lines, is that people have no choice but to think about history when it is happening to them, when major events sweep up entire societies and change people's lives in unimaginable ways. Then you're in a time when you have to think what about history and what it is. One of the dividends of peace, perhaps, was that people were able to pretend that there was no such thing as historical processes. Yeah. There was merely leisure and shopping and so on. Your work also took you to the United States, which is the great civilization of leisure and shopping, but which is also a great historically significant society. And it's often aware of it, too.
Well, the Americans have a different view of freedom from most people, don't they? I mean, freedom really means doing within the law what it is you're capable of doing. And that's not at all a European idea. We don't go in for that. The country that does go in for it is Israel. And part of the opposition to Israel is really opposition to the United States. People don't understand freedom within the law.
Do you think that the United States currently has lost its way or has taken too great a freedom in its political life?
Well, Trump is certainly a free man, isn't he? He does exactly what he feels like doing within the law. At least I presume it's within the law.
So far, it seems to have been. You know, who knows?
Yes, who knows? But I'm very happy in America, and I like it. I like American humour. And I like the American can-do spirit, My father emigrated and went to live there, and I used to go and teach in America. I remember listening to President Reagan when he came to teach to lecture at Berkeley, where I was teaching. And it was a fascinating thing to see, because they all, 3,000 dons, went into the amphitheatre in order to give him a bad time. And after about 5 minutes, they were all laughing. It was a tremendous lesson in not believing the media.
Right. You know? Yes. When you're writing, if you have an idea for a book, that involves a certain can-do spirit, and that you really have to believe that it could be done. How was it writing a book about Unity Mitford, who was perhaps one of the most prominent aristocratic supporters of Hitler in Britain before 1939?
Well, I thought I was going to write a portrait of a fanatic, and it came about because I knew Jessica Mitford. When I was teaching at Berkeley, I lived in her house, and she took my house in London. We exchanged. And there were a lot of Unity's books, and she'd written in the margin, and she suddenly became alive to me because of these comments in the margin. I can remember, for instance, some reference to the Polish corridor, and she'd written in the margin, "What would he want to do with that? March up and down?" And I suddenly saw this little Nazi figure, and I thought I was going to write a portrait of a fanatic. But when I started doing it, and the research, one thing led to another, and I got a whole mass of documentation which I hadn't expected, and then it became a biography. And then you have to ask yourself, what was her influence? I did a lot of interviewing with people, and it became obvious that she had set a sort of example. And if Hitler had invaded, she would have been, no doubt, a rabid enthusiast. And there are many French people who did that when the Germans invaded France, and it would have been the same when the Germans invaded England. So what I was doing was telling the public that Britain's finest hour wasn't absolutely altogether fine. There was some spots in it. And that's, I think, what created the row, which was a tremendous row at the time. I was accused of being a traitor to my class.
Which is a very Soviet-sounding offence.
Enemy of the people, yeah. Yes.
You were airing the dirty laundry in a way, or rather the great what might have been questions, which historians are not really meant to look at, but of course are always present. You concluded that there would have been significant upper class collaboration.
Well, there was a lot of it in the Anglo-German Society and Admiral Domville and all the rest of it. They're all quite well known now, but at that time they were not so well known, and incidentally, people hadn't really studied the French collaboration either.
Which you also wrote about.
Yes, that's right. And the French didn't like my book at all. Well, it was suppressed in France.
But more recently, they have begun to examine the 40s, often because the protagonists are not around.
I think that's right.
In this case, of course, when you wrote about Unity Mitford, a lot of the old supporters of the British Union of Fascists were still around.
Yes. Well, there are people who think that I'm, like Edward Said, of course, whom we mentioned, there are people who think I'm just a mischief maker. I like pointing out the bad spots. But I have a French friend who's a classical scholar, and the Greeks have a word for the spirit that guides you, a daimon. So apparently I have one.
I've noticed this morning, actually, I was reading a review of Kate Atkinson's new novel, which is about a family in Britain in the 1930s who support Mosley and the fascists. And earlier this year, I read Cressida Connolly's, who's Cyril Connolly's daughter, her novel on the same subject. What's the fascination in this? What was a relatively small political party that didn't get an MP into the House of Commons, even though it may have enjoyed support in some areas of society? What's the fascination?
I think they thought that Neville Chamberlain and Mr. Baldwin and so on were extremely boring people and couldn't contribute much to life. And Hitler was going places and building this and making friends with the right people and enemies with the right people. And let's do it.
So there's an element of ambition, in a way, of ambition without restraint.
Yeah, energy, social energy. And he knew how to organise, didn't he? That's what they would have said. In point of fact, we now know that he didn't know how to do these things. Yeah. And the picture of Hitler that we have as all-powerful Führer is not right. And people like Ian Kershaw have given a much more profound portrait of Hitler. But I think at the time it was thought that he got things done. He knew how to do it. And we must do the same. And it was new and energetic. Something of the same sort of thing that people thought about communism.
There's also a feeling in the 1930s of democracy being a failed system, or of liberal democracy in particular, not being able to get things done. We hear similar things being said now. I'm often wary when I read, certainly when people say Donald Trump is a fascist or something, that seems to me like saying he's turning up at the White House in historical costume or something.
Yes,
You know, it's like calling him a Jacobin or something. It doesn't actually explain too much. That said, do you see similarities in the tensions today in European societies and in the loss of confidence in liberal democracy as a system capable of getting things done?
Well, I think what's happened really is that the conservative parties all over Europe, and including in this country, haven't managed to get their message across. And they've not been conserving anything. The tradition is more or less wiped out. And that leaves a space open for somebody on the right. And these extremist people, they're not really extremists, they're all failed conservatives. I'm sorry to say, really, that the immigration is the issue that gives them power. Because nobody's controlled the immigration, nobody's asked the right questions about it, nobody knows what to do about it. It's created a tremendous social muddle. And that's a failure of conservatism, isn't it? And it's opened the way to these people. And how you get out of that now, I can't imagine.
It seems that is a
sort of similarity to the 30s in a way. I mean, it would have been a good thing to ask whether unrestricted immigration from people who've been opposed to the West religiously and politically for 1,500 years, is that a good thing? Well, one might have asked that question, but as far as I can tell, nobody ever paused to ask that question.
No, and it remains a taboo topic in a way, which is why it's left to extremists to exploit, in effect. It strikes me that, you know, if the problems of the 1930s arose from what Churchill called the locust years, the problems of this decade arose from the opposite in a way, which was a two-decade run of affluence and an open system as after the collapse of communism. With not much thought about the long-term stability of societies and a lot of short-term thinking about maximising profit by moving around an open world system. All of the popular movements of the day are against open borders. They're against a cosmopolitan world, in a way, which is the one that you describe as one, the world you come from, in Fault Lines.
Well, I think that a great mistake was made in abolishing the nation state. The thrust against the nation state since 1945 has been misguided, because the nation, I don't think you can have democracy without there being a nation state to put it into. It seems to me impossible to have an EU that is also democratic. It's not going to happen. People need to know that their identity is fixed as French, British, Greek, whatever it is. If you tell them, as a matter of fact, you aren't British, French or Greek, you're European, what? Who, what does this mean? I'm to die for something abstract like that? It's just an organizing word, Europe. It doesn't mean anything. So the fact that the nation state's been pulverized is, I think, the Conservatives should never have allowed that to happen. There should have been people like Edmund Burke and de Tocqueville saying, we need the nation state because that's where the people that we are. And nobody's going to fiddle around with my identity. And I'm not going to be told I'm something other by you. But there aren't such people. And Mr. Edmund Burke, where are you now? We want you. I suppose there are people slightly in the margin who say it, like, for instance, Roger Scruton. But you see how he gets blackguarded all over the place for saying what needs to be said. So that's a failure of conservatism to get across the fact that there is tradition And what we do is take that tradition and then mold it to suit ourselves if we have to, but not to abolish it. The left want to abolish it. If we were to enter the EU, I think, and I dread the future of the EU for this purpose. It's bound to lead to violence. People are going to say, "I'm not actually going to obey you. Sorry." And then somebody will say, "Oh yes, you are." And the next thing you know, is the guns are firing. And I want to be somewhere else when the rubble begins to fall.
It's very hard to imagine people who had lived under the European Union having the same nostalgic feelings as people when they look back on the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Roman Empire, for that matter.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to have inculcated any great amount of affection, let alone respect, among many populations.
I remember going to Hungary in the height of the Cold War. The clerk in the hotel where we booked in said, "Oh, you've been to Hungary before. If only we had the Habsburgs back. If only we could have them." And this was a man doing his communist job.
Well, it probably would have been good for literature.
It would have been.
If they'd had the Habsburgs back. Now, you are only in your ninth decade and you are still writing.
I am.
What are you currently working on?
Well, I've had, as I've been saying, I had a lot of contact with writers, and some of them are quite well-known people, as you were saying, like Somerset Maugham and Berenson and so on. So I've collected books that they've signed, and I've got about 100, I would say, and I'm writing the history of that book, the author of that book, and my relationship to that author. So I hope it's kind of history, literary criticism, and plain old gossip.
It's history as you lived it, which history is the higher gossip.
That's right.
Well, David Price Jones, thank you very much.
It was great fun. Thank you.
I'm Dominic Green, and you've been listening to the Spectator USA Life and Arts podcast. Today I was casting the pod with David Price Jones. Join us next week and look for us on iTunes under Spectator USA. Thank you.